Welcome back. Say hello on Twitter, at Richard Serrett. Astronomers have known that galaxies across the universe are behaving badly. Some are spinning too fast, while others are just way too hot, and still others glommed into superstructures too quickly. But they don't know why. Perhaps some new hidden particle like dark matter could explain the weirdness, or perhaps gravity is acting on these coalescing clusters of stars in a way scientists hadn't expected. For decades, astronomers have debated the possibilities. While most astronomers believe that dark matter exists, some still think that we need to modify our theory of gravity. However, new research has found a critical flaw in modified gravity theories. They allow for effects to occur without causes, and for information to travel faster than the speed of light. This is bad. Well, for modified gravity, that is. You can read more of this story in the news section up at coasttocoastam.com. Back to more of my conversation with Derek P. Gilbert, author of Giants, Gods, and Dragons, right here on Coast to Coast AM. Giants are real. The small g gods of the pagans are real. Dragons are real. And they're preparing for the final war with God. Giants, Gods, and Dragons, Exposing the Fallen Realm and the Plot to Ignite the Final War of the Ages. Derek Gilbert, co-author, along with his wife, Sharon. Tartarus, Derek, what is Tartarus and where is it?
Well, that's a good question. And according to the Greeks, it was a separate level of the underworld as far below Hades as the earth is below heaven. What's interesting and what most Christians don't realize is that Tartarus is referenced in the Bible in the context of these old entities. The angels who sinned in 2 Peter 2, verse 4, were thrust down to hell in our English Bibles, but the word there is Tartarus. So apparently this is a special area of the underworld that's reserved for supernatural threats to the divine order, according to Peter, and also Jude, who mentions them, these sinning angels in verses 6 and 7 of his short book. They're in chains in gloomy darkness, and they will stay there until the judgment. In other words, they're there until Armageddon.
And so then how will they escape, if you will? How will they be allowed to participate in the final war against good and evil?
Well, that is the province of God. Apparently, he allows them to escape for just a short period of time. In Revelation chapter 9, an angel, described as a star fallen from heaven, and in the Bible, very often stars are used as a symbol or a metaphor for angels. This angel is given the key to the shaft of the bottomless pit, and he allows these things out. Now, a lot of end times prophecy scholars will look at these things, which are described as like these like locusts from hell, which in a sense they are, and try to naturalize them. For example, they've been described as John's attempt to describe attack helicopters. And so this is describing some sort of future war global war. No, these are the entities that are currently locked up in the abyss. These are the angels who sinned, the sons of God mentioned in Genesis chapter 6, verses 1 through 4. What's interesting is that in Revelation 9, and this is one of the clues, I think, that we can point to these sinning angels from Genesis 6 as those that are allowed out of the abyss in Revelation chapter 9, these locust things are given 5 months to torment humans who don't have the seal of God in their foreheads. When we go back to Genesis chapter 8, we mentioned that it was in the book of Genesis, the flood of Noah that destroyed the giants that were produced by these unholy unions of the sons of God, these fallen angels and human women. We read in Genesis chapter 8 that the ark was on the water for 150 days before it came to rest in the mountains of Ararat. In a 30-day lunar, at a calendar based on a 30-day lunar month, that's exactly 5 months. So it's kind of a bookending there. 5 months while these entities in the abyss were helpless to prevent their children, the giants, the Nephilim, from being destroyed by the waters of the flood. At the end of time, the last battle, leading up to the last battle, they get 5 months to torment humanity before God puts a stop to it.
Do we know how many fallen angels are locked up in Tartarus?
We don't, but according to the Book of First Enoch, if we go by that as a guide, and you know, we can only trust that insofar as it helps us understand what little information we're given in the Bible. According to First Enoch, it was 200 who descended onto Mount Hermon in the days of Jared, with Shemaiah, their chief, and there are a number of others mentioned, including Azazel or Azael. So if we use that as a guide, it's 200. But we don't know that for certain. I tend not to be dogmatic about stuff like that unless it's actually in the Bible, or if it can be, you know, supported some other way. But the Bible would be the ultimate authority there. That really, we don't know. It's not in the Bible.
So the fallen angels gathered at, or landed, if you will, at Mount Hermon. Do we know exactly where Mount Hermon is? I mean, is it still a place on the map?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. It is the mountain that is essentially marks the border between Israel, Lebanon, and Syria today. The Israelis captured part of it in the 1967 war, and they built a ski resort. You can actually go skiing on Mount Hermon. United Nations has an observation post on the summit, 9,200 and some odd feet above sea level. But interestingly, there is a temple that was built on the summit of Mount Hermon. And in September of 1869, an explorer for the Palestine Exploration Fund by the name of Charles Warren, Sir Charles Warren later, climbed the mountain and found this temple. Other explorers had found it, so they knew it was there. The locals call it Qasr Antar. But he found an artifact inside the temple that had been overlooked for more than 2,000 years. It's a stela. That's a stone slab that had been carved in archaic Greek. So probably not older than about the 4th century B.C. when Alexander the Great and his armies overran the land that became Israel, that was Israel. And in this archaic Greek, the inscription reads something like, "By the order of the Most High and Holy God, those who swore an oath proceed from here." He actually was able to take that slab down the mountain. He cut it down because it was like 4 feet high, about 18 inches wide and 12 inches thick, so it weighed about 6,000 pounds. He shaved it down to about 4 inches thick, and in bringing it down the mountain on with donkeys and a sledge, it broke into two pieces. But he shipped it back to the British Museum, and it's at the British Museum today. Scholars agree this is a reference to the Watchers. Somebody, probably in the 4th or 3rd century B.C., carved that stone and left it in this temple, 9,200 feet above sea level.
Have you been to Mount Hermon?
We have, actually. We've been in the foothills of Mount Hermon. You can also see it from a lookout at Mount Bentall, which is a site that allows visitors to look down into Syria. So, there's a nature preserve on one of the southwest slopes. And, of course, we've also been to the Grotto of Pan, which is at the foot of Mount Hermon, which is in the New Testament era. That was Caesarea Philippi, where Jesus had a very famous conversation with the Apostle Peter, where he asked his disciples, "Who do men say that I am?" And, they, you know, some say you're Elijah, some say you're a prophet, some say you're... But then he turned to Peter and asked him, "Who do you say that I am?" And Peter said, "Well, you're the Christ, the Son of the living God." And Jesus said, "Blessed are you, Simon Barjona, for man has not revealed this to you, but only God in heaven." And then he said, "On this rock I will build my church." Now, there are some who take that to mean Peter, which is, Petros in Greek means rock. Essentially, Peter's name was, if you wanted to give him a nickname, it would be Rocky. But he was standing in front of a 9,200-foot mountain that everyone in the ancient world knew was the home of the Canaanite creator god El and his 70 sons, where the Watchers had descended thousands of years earlier and created this mess that caused all the problems of the world by introducing knowledge, forbidden knowledge, that humanity wasn't supposed to know. I think Jesus was referring to that mountain right behind him. "On this rock I will build my church, and the gates of hell," which, by the way, are right over here, "will not prevail against it," because Caesarea Philippi was right in front of the Grotto of Pan, which was believed to be the literal entrance to the netherworld.
So when you're at Mount Hermon, does it have kind of a different vibe? I mean, if this is in fact where the fallen angels gathered, one would think that it would have, I don't know, a certain dark energy to it.
I'll be honest, we didn't detect it, or at least I didn't detect it. Now, my wife is a lot more sensitive to things like that than I am. There were other places that we've been on our tours of Israel that have a stranger feel to it. For example, we were able to go inside the central core of Gilgal Rephaim, which is, they call it the Stonehenge of the Middle East. And in there, we kind of felt a weird vibe, but didn't detect it on Mount Hermon. But then again, we weren't on the summit either. You can't get up there because of the situation between Israel, Lebanon, and Syria.
So confirm or deny, if you can, that Mount Hermon is on the same degree latitude that Roswell, New Mexico is, or specifically the location of the UFO crash in Corona, New Mexico.
Yes. The late David Flynn wrote an article about this some years ago that's been archived on the web. We had the opportunity to interview David about that a couple of times. It's been a while, so I don't remember the specifics. He was a genius when it came to finding those weird synchronicities with numbers. One of his books, The Temple at the Center of Time, did that same sort of look at the location of the temple in Jerusalem. But yeah, he wrote a long and detailed and well-researched piece on the occult signature of the 1947 Roswell crash and compared it to the location of Mount Hermon.
So what would be the significance of that, do you suppose? If Mount Hermon and the UFO crash near Roswell are on the same degree latitude, what is that saying? What is it telling us?
Well, that the UFO phenomenon is a deception from the fallen realm. Now, Josh Peck and I, several years ago, wrote a book called The Day the Earth Stands Still, which is a play on the old movie, The Day the Earth Stood Still. And we distinguish between UAPs and the alien abduction phenomenon. There are plenty of things in the air. In fact, I would suggest, it's my opinion, I don't know this for a fact, but it's my opinion that the recent talk about disclosure based on the radar cameras and those F-18s, the USS Nimitz incident and others like it with the fast-moving, what appear to be drones, might be some sort of secret government craft. But the abduction phenomenon is definitely real. It is definitely not natural. It is supernatural. I think researchers like Jacques Vallée were on the right track there when you were looking at interdimensional entities rather than extraterrestrial. So what would the 1947 crash be? It may have been a government deception to cover up research that we didn't want the Russians to know about. On the other hand, it might have been the principalities and powers trying to get humans focused on other answers for the big questions of life that are in the Bible. For example, why are we here? Where did we come from? What happens when we die? The Bible answers those questions, but when you go to UFO gatherings, conferences like the annual Roswell gathering or McMinnville, Oregon, or Eureka Springs, Arkansas, a lot of people are there looking for not the technological answers for how we cross the vast emptiness of space, but what happens to us when we die? Spiritual answers. They're looking for spiritual answers.
I want to talk about your wife, Sharon, the co-author of the book, for a moment, because she's also, not only is she, obviously heavily into biblical prophecy, but she's also a microbiologist. And it was interesting because your publisher, Thomas Horn at Skywatch, he asked Sharon to write a book back in 2014 or do a presentation, I'm not sure which, sort of marrying the two, biblical prophecy and her expertise in microbiology and what was happening in 2014 while we had this Ebola outbreak. So just talk to me a little bit about the connections that she made.
Yeah, she wrote a book called Ebola and the Fourth Horseman of the Apocalypse. And of course, that's the rider on the pale green horse, whose name is Death, and Hell or Hades follows with him. She wrote a book that thankfully became obsolete very quickly because that outbreak burned out. Well, the origin of Giants, Gods, and Dragons was the COVID pandemic. Tom asked Sharon, as a molecular biologist, to compare this pandemic to the rider on the pale horse. What is the significance thereof? And wanting to make this a little more evergreen than the Ebola book, which again, we're glad became obsolete very quickly, we decided to expand it out a little bit. And as you mentioned at the top of the program, we host a weekly video program called Unraveling Revelation. And we found that you really can't understand end times prophecy unless you understand the Old Testament and what the Greeks and the Romans and the Canaanites and the Babylonians knew about the spirit realm, because a lot of what's in there, a lot of the imagery that John employs only makes sense if you understand what the Mesopotamians knew about the spirit realm. Well, she based her book in 2014 and the start of this book, again, on the idea that the beasts that accompany the rider on the pale horse, that are given license to kill humanity, the wild beasts of the earth, the word in Greek is therion, and that's actually a diminutive form of the word, the Greek word for beast. And so she reasoned, well, okay, if this diminutive form, meaning a small or a tiny beast, perhaps we're not talking about, you know, lions and tigers and bears, maybe we're talking about bacteria and viruses. And that was the genesis of the book, Ebola and the Fourth Horseman of the Apocalypse, and Giants, Gods, and Dragons. But again, we expanded it out to look at the other writers of the apocalypse and then prophecy, end times prophecy in general.
So I want to begin to discuss in more detail the horsemen of the apocalypse, the four horsemen we call them, but there may have been five. We mm-hmm. just got a couple minutes here before the bottom of the hour break, so let's just start talking about it now, and then we'll continue again afterwards. So four horsemen or five?
Well, if you include Hades, who's riding behind death, and the Greek name for death is Thanatos, and that's really what gave us the idea that perhaps the other riders were known entities in the Greek or Greco-Roman pantheon who have cognates or correlates in the Canaanite or Amorite pantheon, the Babylonian pantheons as well. You see the opening of the fourth seal. You've got the pale horse or the green horse, and its rider's name was Thanatos. Hades followed him. Hades, of course, we know is the brother of Zeus and Poseidon. What's interesting about that is that the word followed in Greek actually implies that he's like a page or almost a servant or a fanboy, if you will, of death. And I guess that makes sense because Hades is, he would have no clientele if death was not doing his thing. So Hades is following death. I don't know, maybe like a motorcycle riding in a sidecar, something like that. So we've got four horsemen, but yeah, you've got Hades riding along. So you actually have five riders. We mentioned the rider on the white horse, Apollo. The rider on the red horse is pretty easy. That's the god of war, Ares, who was known to the Moabites, the national god of Moab, the neighbors of ancient Israel, as Chemosh. And the rider on the black horse, really interesting, and that took us a little more research to get into. We believe that is Hermes or Mercury, and explaining why will take a little bit of time.
All right, well, we'll take some time on the other side. Derek Gilbert, co-author of Giants, Gods, and Dragons, and we will open up the phone lines at the top of the hour, taking questions and comments. Back with more right here on Coast to Coast AM. A team of divers will soon descend upon a sunken Nazi steamer ship that they suspect could contain the legendary lost Amber Room. The intriguing vessel was discovered off the coast of Poland last autumn and determined to be a sizable craft known as the Karlsruhe, which hastily fled East Prussia in 1945 at the chaotic close of World War II. The city from which it departed, Königsberg, was the last location where the famed Amber Room, an ornate set of gold and amber panels pilfered from a Russian palace by the Nazis, was last seen. These details have led some researchers to suspect that the downed ship might just be the final resting place of the lost treasure. Wow, that's a long unsolved mystery, the disappearance of the Amber Room. That would be remarkable if they finally put that one to bed. More of my conversation with Derek Gilbert, co-author of Giants, Gods, and Dragons, right here on Coast to Coast AM. Derek, before the break at the bottom of the hour, you were discussing the four horsemen, or five, if you'd rather, if we include Hades as the fifth rider. You were explaining the identity of, I believe it was the black horse?
The rider on the black horse, this is typically identified as Famine. This is the third seal, and he comes forth. He's holding a pair of scales, the voice in the midst of the four living creatures, those will be the cherubim around the throne of God, saying, a quart of wheat for a denarius and three quarts of barley for a denarius, and do not harm the oil and the wine. The word translated scales in English is actually the Greek word zugos, which means yoke. And so we argue in the book that what the rider on the black horse represents is economic serfdom, servitude, slavery. It's the kind of yoke that you put on the neck of oxen to pull the pull a plow or to tread out the grain. To give context, a denarius back in the first century AD when John wrote the book of Revelation was equal to a day's wages for a laborer. So if we use just for a round number, say $15 an hour, which there are, some political movement here in the United States pushing for a $15 an hour minimum wage. Just to use that as a round number, after taxes, that's about $84 a day for a day's worth of wheat or barley, because the amount described in the book of Revelation there is enough to keep one person alive for one day. So again, rounding off for taxes and over a 30-day month, that's about $2,500 a month just to buy enough food for one person to survive, working 7 days a week. So what we're talking about is economic grinding poverty. That, in our view, is similar to what appeared to be on the verge of happening with this this whole COVID pandemic and the economies of the world essentially being crashed into a wall. I don't think we're there yet, Sharon, and I don't believe that we're on the verge of seeing the rise of the Antichrist or anything like that, like this year or anything like that. But it's going to look something like this, where there will be a crisis that will cause people to cry out and demand global intervention, some sort of global government to intervene. But as we were looking at what entity, again, based on the assumption that since John named the rider on the fourth horse and his companion, Thanatos and Hades, known entities in the Greek pantheon, who would the rider on the black horse be? I mentioned before the break, we think it's Hermes or Mercury in the Roman pantheon, known to the Babylonians as Nabu. He was one of the most popular gods of the period of Babylonian history of Nebuchadnezzar, the king who sacked Jerusalem, destroyed the temple. Nabu was the scribe. He was the god of scribes. He was the one who was followed by a special class of educated people. Babylon in the 6th century BC, most people were illiterate, so you had to go to a scribe whose patron god was Nabu and have him write the letter for you, write the will for you, write up the deed of sale for you, that sort of thing. But they also kept track of the ledgers, the accounts, who owed what to which temple. In fact, just within the last decade or so, they found a small temple in Babylon for the god Nabu of accounts. And again, when this deity was transferred westward to the Greek culture and then the Roman culture, he changed names. Mercury, in fact, is the based on the same word from which we get the modern word merchandise and merchant and mercantile. So
interesting.
Yeah. So the god of scribes, the god of accounts. And what's really fascinating is we were trying to research this. This is one of those things that pops up. It's like either somebody's got a sense of humor or the spirit realm is just having a laugh at our expense. Back in 2009, after the subprime mortgage collapse, the folks at MasterCard introduced a new service fee that all merchants have to pay whenever anyone swipes a debit card or a credit card from MasterCard. It's like 2 cents per transaction. And they could have called it anything, internet fee or usage fee or merchant fee or whatever. They decided to call it the Network Access Brand Usage Fee, or the NABU. So every time you swipe a MasterCard, you're paying 2 cents to NABU. And again, this gets back to this idea of economic servitude. We're living in an age where credit card debt, consumer debt, personal debt, is crushing an entire generation of people. Student loan debt is the next bubble to pop. Kids getting out of college today with an average of like $35,000 in student loans. And as of the time we wrote the book, and this number has grown since then, but as of the time we wrote the book, some 11% of student debts were more than 90 days past due. And that was before the numbers had caught up to the economic shutdown, the COVID lockdowns. So this is leading to the Great Reset Initiative and this drive to completely restructure the global economy. And as the World Economic Forum promises us, this is at their website, by the year 2030, we will own nothing and we will be happy. Well, again, we're not saying that that's fulfillment of Bible prophecy, but this is kind of what it's going to look like when that day finally gets here.
Speaking of, what's in your wallet and so forth, you draw connections between Babel, as in the Tower of Babel, Babylon, and our wallets. So what is the connection?
Well, again, that's the god Nabu, who emerged as essentially the vizier or the assistant of the chief god of Babylon, Marduk. And this idea that Nabu is connected to the idea of accounts and ledgers and debt servitude. But going back even further to about 5,000 years or more, there was a period of history scholars called the Uruk period, U-R-U-K. That was a city in southeast Iraq, and Iraq is just the same name as Uruk, just spelled differently, where a king named Nimrod tried to set up the world's first empire. He's also known for being the one who tried to build the Tower of Babel. Now, I've argued in a couple of books, and we kind of restated the case here in Giants, Gods, and Dragons, that the Tower of Babel was not at Babylon, because Babylon wasn't founded until more than 1,200 years after the end of the Uruk period and after Nimrod would have lived. But it was at an ancient city called Eridu. And the whole point of Babel was to build an abode of the gods. And that's, I think, why God of the Bible had to put a stop to it. But the defining feature for archaeologists of the city-state of Uruk, which dominated Mesopotamia for about 900 years, everywhere from the Persian Gulf up to the mountains of Turkey, was under the control of Uruk. When archaeologists find a site, they can tell that it comes from that period of history by the presence of what's called a beveled rim bowl. It's a crudely made clay bowl that almost looks like something a kid would make out of Play-Doh. They were not fired. They were probably formed on the ground, and just the purpose of these bowls was to essentially put enough barley or grain in it for a workman to go out in the field and sustain him for a day. It was his daily ration. And archaeologists have concluded this because the pictogram or the logogram in ancient Sumerian for bread is a drawing of this little crudely made beveled rim bowl. And the symbol for to eat, the verb to eat, is somebody holding one of these bowls up to his mouth. So they conclude that this is how you pay. And archaeologists, when they find a site dated to this period of history, Nimrod's kingdom, Uruk, they find hundreds, sometimes thousands of these bowls. They were essentially the 5,000-year-old equivalent of a styrofoam fast food container, single-use, disposable. And they find these all over ancient Mesopotamia. I suggest in the book, since this is the section I wrote, my degree is bachelor's in economics, I argue that this is the ancient Mesopotamian equivalent or the Sumerian equivalent of universal basic income.
interesting connection. Wow, well done.
Dependent on the government for your daily bread. And again, that's what Nimrod was known for, trying to set up a global empire.
Is there a connection between any of the four horsemen and near Earth objects, these comets? We've had some near misses, the comets Atlas and Swan, I believe. And they're also they're considered green comets, which sometimes the pale horse is called the green horse, right?
Yeah, the word in Greek is chloros, from which we get the word chlorophyll. So it's like the pale, sickly green that you get when your stomach is really upset. There are some when the trumpet judgments arrive in Revelation chapter 8, there are a couple of events that take place, and Tom Horn, of course, has written about one of them in the Wormwood Prophecy, and that would be the third angel, the third angel. Great star falls from heaven, and again, star representing an angel, perhaps. It falls on a third of the rivers, the springs of the water. The name of the star is Wormwood. The waters become wormwood, which is bitter, poisonous. Many people die from the water. The second trumpet blows, and a great mountain burning with fire is thrown into the sea. Well, of course, these sound like asteroids or comets slamming into the planet. We took a slightly different view of this and argue that all of the trumpet judgments are supernatural. Again, we're dealing with entities here, and not only do stars in the Bible represent angels, but the third trumpet or the second trumpet, the great mountain, that was actually the epithet. Great mountain was the epithet of the chief god of Mesopotamia, Enlil, before the rise of Marduk around 1000 BC. So Enlil, who is in the book I'm working on now for later this year, is to be equated with Cronos of the Greeks and Saturn with the Romans, the former chief god of the pantheon, who is then demoted and banished to the netherworld, was literally called Great Mountain. His temple, called the Ikur, which means house of the mountain or mountain house. His another equivalent, Dagon, the chief god of the Philistines, likewise called the Great Mountain. So we argue that this is actually an entity fallen to earth, a spirit. Now, does it mean that it won't be an asteroid? Well, it could be an asteroid as well. We're just suggesting the possibility, that given what John knew about his neighbor's beliefs, the pagan beliefs about the spirit realm around him, it's just as likely, in our view, that what we're looking at here are angels doing damage to the earth instead of rocks falling from the sky.
Just getting back to Wormwood for a second and Thomas Horn's book, and he identifies the this huge planet-killing space rock, Apophis, which is supposed to swing by when? April of 2030? 2029? Right. Now, Apophis is the Egyptian god for chaos. Mm-hmm. So talk to me about chaos, because this gets into a whole discussion about the identity of the first spirit to rebel against God, which was not Satan, actually.
Yeah. In Genesis 1:1 and 1:2, we have heard these verses. Any of us who've been in church ever have probably heard these verses. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The earth was without form and void, and darkness was over the face of the deep. Well, the Hebrew word translated deep is tahom, which is essentially a cognate, same word, different language, for the Sumerian word Tiamat. And Tiamat was their version of this primordial chaos dragon or chaos monster that in the Bible is called Leviathan. The Egyptian version of this is Apophis. The Greek version is Typhon. There is a Canaanite version called Yam. The Norse pantheon, Jormungandr. The Hittites and Hurrians had one called Ilyonka. Common theme where a warrior god had to defeat this chaos monster in order to produce the natural order that the world in which humans could live. It's just that in the Bible, that fight is over by the second verse of Genesis 1. In all of these other pantheons, even mighty Zeus had to have help from Pan. Baal in the Canaanite pantheon had to have special clubs made that he used to subdue Yam, the chaos monster, by beating him into submission. So all of these stories are very, very similar. The defeat of chaos, primordial chaos, by a warrior god is just, again, the one difference is that in the Bible, the version of God defeating Leviathan, which is recounted in Psalm 74, it's over very, very quickly. It's been subdued. This first rebel has been subdued, but will not ultimately be destroyed until Revelation 21, where we read there will be a new heaven and a new earth, and the sea is no more. The relevant point there is that the sea in the Bible often represents that primordial chaos.
So is there a connection then between the Leviathan and Apophis, the asteroid? I mean, does it mean that chaos is coming back in the form of an asteroid?
That would be speculative. We think that Leviathan is actually the spirit behind the Antichrist that emerges from the sea, again, emerging from the abyss at the beginning of Revelation chapter 13. So we tend to view them as different entities. But again, when it comes to end times prophecy, it's like Paul wrote, we see as though into a glass darkly. We're in a dark room looking into a mirror, so everything is backwards and dimly lit. So we reserve the right to be wrong.
Do we know the exact location of where the Antichrist will emerge from the sea?
We don't, but our theory is that it will be coming out of the eastern Mediterranean. There's a mountain called Jebel al-Akra in Turkey. It's on the border with Syria. It's very near ancient Antioch. That mountain in ancient times was called Mount Safon. And everyone in the ancient world knew that was where Baal's palace was located. Again, Jesus identified Baal, Zeus, as Satan. In fact, the Greeks believe that's where Zeus defeated the chaos monster Typhon. And at the end of Revelation 12, we see that Satan is standing on the shore of the sea. And in Revelation 13, verse 1, this entity, the beast, the Antichrist, emerges from the sea. So it would seem that it would make sense if this were to happen right next to the mountain that Satan declared, or Baal declared, as his holy mountain.
All right, we'll take a time out now, top of the hour. When we come back, we'll open the phone lines, questions, and comments for Derek Gilbert, co-author of Giants, Gods, and Dragons. Well, we've talked about giants, we've talked about gods. It's time to discuss dragons. We'll do that. First order of business on the other side. Coast to Coast AM returns in mere moments. Stay with us.